All right, welcome everybody. We are Parshas Balotcha. This is the third parsha in the book of Bamidbar, and the title is "When Should You Walk Away from a Raise?" All right, so tonight we're going to start a video. This is a person I work with. This is a story about Morris Smith, and I'm going to share the story. But basically, Morris Smith worked at Fidelity, which is the brokerage house. And he started there on the ground floor at age 24 as a basic analyst. He was a CPA before doing that, public accounting before that. And he started off in 1980, he started off making $34,000 in 1982. He was fortunate to be part of Fidelity that grew with the bull market of the 1980s, and he was there for after 10 years. He rose, and the famous Peter Lynch, who was a Wall Street legend, was running the Magellan Fund. The Magellan Fund at that point had $13 billion under management. Largest mutual fund in the world at the time. Peter Lynch retired, and they asked Morris, aka Moshe Smith, to take over. That's where the story begins. And let us go to the videotape.
So you took over the Magellan Fund at $13 billion. You grew it to $20 billion, beating the stock market by nearly 7% over the 2 years. And you were doing really well. So if I had to guess, for the next 30 years, you were leading the Magellan Fund and everything was super splendid. What happened?
Right. So very good question. Yeah, obviously, it's been asked of me before also. And this is a true story. It's been written about, but it's really true. I was shopping in Shaw's supermarket in Sharon on Erev Pesach, I believe, of 1992. And I had not been in the supermarket for quite a while. And I think I was literally shopping for romaine lettuce. And it struck me that I had just the sort of like the day-to-day normality of life had escaped me, especially those last 2 years. Working on Magellan was extremely intense. My work weeks were 70 hours plus. I didn't have a free minute because there was so much to do. And it's not just 2 years, it's 10 years in the investment business. People don't recognize, unless you're in the business, the intensity of the position is incredible. You know, there's obviously you want to be successful, but what's so unusual about the investment business is you're literally graded at 4 o'clock every day. And, you know, people could work at a job and never be graded their entire life or being graded once a year when they sit down for their reviews. That's not that way in the investment business. I don't need someone sitting across me to give me a performance review. The performance review occurs daily. And I am a type A personality, very intense. And I was hard on myself that way. And I just needed a break. I felt that way. And, you know, Devar and I spoke about it over Pesach. And we decided that this was the right decision was, you know, to take a break, to go to Israel. And, you know, the firm tried to convince me otherwise for about a week, and they really offered me a leave of absence, et cetera. But I just needed a career shift, I felt, at that time. And, you know, Fidelity had opened up so many doors for me in a sense that, you know, financially, you know, we had done reasonably well over those years. And also, another key fact was that, as I mentioned before, the career compression. You know, I'd been there 10 years. There was nothing else, quote unquote, to accomplish professionally. I'd been able to run Magellan pretty well over that period and had been successful in the funds before. And so you're right. I could continue to match money. There's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, I think it's a great field to be in. But I just wanted to rebalance myself to some degree. And the idea of leaving and, you know, going to Israel at that point was very important. And I've mentioned it before. It's, you know, life is not just based upon one direction. And while I was able to help with the kids still, and even, you know, as far as my own personal growth, I felt it was too disproportionate in the sense that I had to give so much of my time to work. And, you know, I've quoted the great football coach, Vince Lombardi, from the Green Bay Packers. And, you know, he often compared life to a tripod, that you have your interrelationship with God, your interrelationship with your family, and your interrelationship with your work. And those are the three stools quite over that many people's lives evolve around. And I felt that that tripod had got disproportionately pushed to one side, and I really wanted to rebalance it. So that was really the driving force. Plus, in addition to that, both Devar and myself had a real interest and love in moving to Israel. We had both grown up very, I think, Zionistic. I don't mind mentioning today happens to be Yom Yerushalayim, the day of the celebration of capturing the city of Jerusalem in 1967. And that was one of our goals, was to try to go to Israel and see if we could make Aliyah and see how that would work. So we decided we would go for a year and see how things would work out. And so that was really the genesis of that decision. You know, it's interesting looking back at that. You know, Devar and I had talked over my time at Fidelity how much money would you quote-unquote need to leave at a certain point. Mm-hmm. You know, so I did well at Fidelity, but not like the crazy amounts of money that are made today when people run hedge funds. In a mutual fund, you don't get paid like that. And the truth is, most of the compensation I made over the years was being a shareholder, either real or phantom stock I had at Fidelity, was not based on salary as much. So, but again, it worked out well. I had no complaints, obviously. And it was enough that I was able to make a move to Israel. And with the mindset within Israel that I, you know, one of the goals I had was to be able to learn part-time, and I would continue working part-time, really managing my own money, which I've really, that more or less, that has been the way my life has been the last 30 years.
I would say most people would not, at that point in their 30s, didn't even hit their mid-30s, decide to move on and take a sabbatical for an extended period of time in Israel. Do you recognize that that is not the norm, in that most people would continue climbing the corporate ladder if it was too stressful, or if you're a type A personality, figure out how to balance it without giving up that opportunity? Are you cognizant of that?
So it's hard to, when you're on a whirlwind, when you're going through that. Again, if you're going through the 30-year progression through corporate America, I could see that. It's a slower pace. The investment world is not that pace at all. It was a bit, and especially as we were going through the 80s and at the firm I was at, it was, everything was compressed. And I didn't view it that way at all. In other words, I was looking really from the microcosm of my own glasses and not from other people's perspective. A different personality type could stay in that environment for many, many years, would not be as intense, be able to manage money, et cetera. That's just not my makeup, I guess.
Did you feel yourself aging through the process, or was it just internal?
I don't know if the word is aging, but I was a little bit overweight. I've never been really overweight, but I was a little bit overweight. I did feel stressful in the sense that, you know, I used to have on my desk those balls that you kind of I busted
a few stress.
That's not a good sign. Right. I'm not that strong. You see, it's not like I have strong arms. There, you just feel stress, and that was a factor, I think, involved with it. But again, it's not, there wasn't one factor. It was really, there was many things that were going on in my mind related to that. And I think there was, again, the goal of going to Israel, the goal of spending more time doing Jewish learning, which I really never had an opportunity to do. Those were really important. And spending time with the family in not as stressed, you know, situation. All those things were important factors. It was not one variable. It was many variables that went into the decision. It wasn't a rash decision. The decision to at that day was, quote unquote, I decided I wanted to leave. But that was building up, I would say. You know, I'll put it in different terms. There were probably once or twice a year, the five prior years, I had thought about leaving. And that may have been to another firm, et cetera. But that was because of all those stresses involved. You see them as you're going through them. Yet, you know, you go into the office the next day. You think about it, but you don't act. But this was one time, I guess, because I really felt like I had sort of accomplished what I wanted to, that gave me an opportunity to do other things.
And now a word from a sponsor.
All right. All right. Okay, so when Moshe Smith has taken his mutual fund from $13 billion to $20 billion in 2 years, beat the stock market by 7%. It's Erev Pesach. What experience was sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back in his mind?
Grocery shopping for romaine lettuce. On Erev Pesach, when he had the realization that working at the fund, he was missing out on everyday life, everyday living, the little things, because his job took up so much of his time and of his life.
Exactly. Now he referenced the famous Green Bay Packer coaches, Vince Lombardi, who made an analogy that life can be compared to a three-legged stool. What were the three legs that were mentioned?
It was work life, your home life, and then your church life.
Right, your relationship to God, your relationship to your family, your relationship to your work. And what was the problem with Morris Smith's stool? What was wrong with one of his legs?
Work life was becoming taller than the other two.
So it was basically
off kilter.
Right. So his whole he felt his stool was completely unstable.
Right. It was wobbly.
Wobbly. That's it. Now, so you, I he didn't really. He kind of shared it, but you have to understand, in Wall Street, if you are that successful, you don't walk away. So when he walked into the office after Pesach and he said to them, guys, I need to take a break. I need to spend a sabbatical in Israel with my family, and I'm involved in some Jewish learning. How do you think that went down at Fidelity?
You didn't really go scared them.
Was it like, well, first of all, like they're like, excuse me.
Right. They liked their returns, and they liked, you know, all the money he had brought in, and they didn't want to, you know,
right,
the so golden goose to leave.
Right. They don't want the golden goose to leave, number one. But also it's like, if he said, I'm going to, you know, Goldman Sachs, well, that would make sense to them. You know what I'm saying? You're going from one pot of money to a bigger pot of money. Here, he's going from a big pot of money to, you're going to Israel to learn? Like, in other words, you have to understand, I spoke to him. It did not compute to them. Like, maybe they thought he was, like, mentally ill. Like, what are you, like, in other words, in their world, that is, like, not, like, you know what I'm saying? That didn't make any sense. So, now, what his Jewish learning played a role. Now, let me just see if I get to the point there. His basic point was that he grew up modern Orthodox guy. He went to 12 years of day school education. He did do a year in Israel, but he never got really into learning. You know what I'm saying? And now he's 34 years old. He wants to give that a shot. So then he, as he mentioned, he went there, he went to a yeshiva, he learned, he did a daf yomi, he did learning for half a day, and he made sufficient money that he could invest his own money. And he certainly knows how to invest money, clearly. That's what he did. So, all right. What do you think? Did he feel happiness with his decision or regret from his decision?
Well, I mean, he seemed like he was relieved, so I'd say happy. You know, he's not working 14-hour days anymore.
As they say, let us go to the videotape where he answers that question directly. So let's go.
Be experienced. You're a few months into your Jerusalem sabbatical. You're sitting there. You're learning the Talmud, learning Gemara, and you look out the window. And did you feel a certain sense of, I made the right decision? Did you have any regret? What was that like?
Great question. So on the personal perspective, I can't say enough about that decision. I look back in my own life. It was probably, it's among the top three or four most important decisions I made on a personal basis in my life. It changed me from the perspective that Torah took a real central part of my life going forward. And it's been since that day. And as you say, you know, I used to go to the Old City every morning for 7 years. I would go to the Old City. I went to Daf Yomi in the Old City. And then I would sit in the basement of Shavesh Torah, sort of a coincidental story. I had been, I'd given a class really on strategic planning at Aish the summer of 92 when we moved to Israel, spoke to Rabbein for a number of hours, and they asked me, why don't you come sit in the Beis Medrash? So I just ended up doing that. It was a great place to learn in the morning. So I would be in the Beis Medrash from 9:30 till about 12:30 every morning. And, you know, you're overlooking, you know, literally the Kotel, Har HaBayit. It's just incredible, the Temple Mount. And it was a fantastic experience. And plus the fact that I was able to spend part of my day learning and then part of my day working, which I love the investment business. It's not as if I didn't leave the business because I hated the investment business. I left the business for other reasons. I think it's a great field for people to go into, very challenging. It's changed a lot. But from the time period I worked, I loved it. And I used to continue to do that. That's what I did in the afternoon. I'd come home. I'd be home at a normal time with the kids, and I wouldn't have night things to worry about. It was really wonderful.
So was there any sense of regret at any point in the beginning, middle, end stages of this decision?
I can honestly say, looking back, there's never been a regret about the decision to leave Fidelity, ever. I mean, and again, I only have great things to say about the company. It was a fantastic experience. I worked with an incredible group of people in the 1980s. I can't say enough about that, or about the organization and the way I was treated. So nothing, you know, from that end, only positive feelings. But yet, on a personal basis, I felt and feel it was such a correct decision. And it's, you know, it's interesting because, you know, over the last 30 years, you evolve as a person also. And I feel every day I wake up, I'm like the luckiest guy in the world. I get up very early and I spend my morning learning, and I can't believe it. I really mean that. I cannot believe it.
What time are you waking up these days?
Not today because it was Sunday. Yeah. I went to bed at 1 in the morning. But on a typical day, I get up, let's say, on average, about 4:45, plus or minus.
All right. Okay, so he basically made this big move, and he has no regret because it was such a good experience for him. Now, I just want to share, this is somewhat unrelated to the parsha, but he makes an interesting insight in time management. I felt that's valuable, so I just want to, we're going to now have a break in the shiur for a time management point that he shares, which I felt was valuable. So we're going to go to that part because I felt that it of course it relates to Torah, but it's something that it's good.
Very early, and I spend my morning learning, and I can't believe it. I really mean that. I cannot believe it.
What time are you waking up these days?
Not today because it was Sunday. Yeah. I went to bed at 1 in the morning, but on a typical day, I get up, let's say, on average, about 4:45, plus or minus. I mean, I have a great schedule because, you know, I learn from then till 8 o'clock. I daven at 8. I have a chavrusa afterwards with Lenny Feiner, and you know, basically from early in the morning till 9:30, 10, let's call it, I'm involved with Torah, and you know, I spend a couple hours in going through emails and investing. There's things going on because I still manage my own monies. I have it out with a lot of different people, and story in of itself. But in the middle of the day, I learned chavrusa with my grandchildren in Israel. In fact, I learned 5:30 in the morning with one of my grandchildren in Israel, who's in school at that time. He has Seder. And the other beautiful thing is that in the evening, also, I spend a lot of time with grandchildren on FaceTime and even children learning. So I have a wonderful time of interacting with my grandchildren on a unique way, which I would encourage everyone to do. Big learner of Mishnayos with my grandsons. And I have 11 of those, by the way, consecutively before we had 3 granddaughters. Wow. So, and they're just wonderful. And again, having more time to spend with them in that sort of interaction is great. You know, it's interesting because we live all over the world, but I have a real kesher, a real connection with them. And the learning has a lot to do with that.
So people have probably come up to you over the years looking for advice. One question that I would imagine I want to ask you is that, and I'm not in that place, but there are people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s that have done very well financially. What message would you give them to not necessarily make the jump that you made and ship out to Israel, but Should they be seriously considering a recalibration of their tripod, as you called it, if they have done very well financially and they have the breathing room and the ability to do so?
That's a really good question, and I don't think I've ever been asked that question. That I think it's a very important thing for everyone to consider. I can't extrapolate my personal feelings and the desire that I had for growth in certain areas onto other people. Many of those people in the 20s, 30s, 40s may already be spending quite a bit of time. I may have spent many years in yeshiva, and I respect that completely if they really want to be immersed, you know, and try to grow in their, you know, financial success, et cetera. But I do think you have to always recalibrate and see where the tripod is. You can't, again, life is short, and we all recognize that. And you don't want to give up all these years just completely focused just on business, especially if you've made it, quote unquote, financially. Now, everyone may have different definitions of what that is. But I think it is something you have to always be considering. And at a minimum, you should always try to be growing the part of your life that's devoted to your family and devoted to Torah. It should always be a growing part. And especially if you have more wealth, you should try to do as much as you can to grow the other parts of the tripod for your own personal self and for your interaction with your family.
You gave a class I saw on YouTube. I was watching a video to boys in Jerusalem at a yeshiva there, and you were talking about this concept of, I believe, wasting time. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Sure. That is definitely one of my hot buttons, as I would say. And I, even going back to what you just discussed on the prior question, sometimes it's just better time management for you to get more out of the day, and you don't have to necessarily even give up time at work to be able to maximize your potential. So we've all been, I think, to some degree, what's happened with the internet, smartphones, et cetera, it's drawn us, it used to be television, so I don't know if it's any different, but we sort of end up wasting, quote unquote, a lot of time. And we're all human, and we do the best we can. You know, none of us are Avraham Kanievsky, as that's all. However, the amount of time we waste, you know, wasting time is like the worst thing you could possibly do in your life, because God gave you a certain amount of time in this world to maximize your potential in creating change and doing good things, etc. When you quote unquote waste time, you can never get that back. It is a lost asset that you had. So when I'm speaking to them, and it's the message they've gotten different yeshivas, different places over the years, is that I think most wasted time is later at night. And what do I mean by that? I think if most people look at themselves, their efficiency levels go down in the evening. And you start, you know, surfing the net, wasting your time in front of television, whatever you're doing, it tends to be less productive. And I'm a huge fan of getting up early. The earlier you get up, the less you'll have. First of all, the fresher your mind will be, and the lesser the distractions. And those are the two key factors. At night, you get phone calls, this and that, and emails, etc. It's just really bad in that sense. And what I tell these younger students is, if you would go to sleep just a half hour earlier, I mean, I could probably do a lot more than that, but at least a half hour earlier, and get up a half hour earlier in the morning, you're going to change your life. So you have 180 hours more a year to learn. And that, I don't care what you're doing in life, you could spend those 180 hours learning, and you could change yourself completely. No matter what you like to learn, that can change you as a person. And I've had people come over to me in subsequent years and tell me that that message resonated, made a difference in their life. And that's why I emphasize it.
Yeah. Like you mentioned.
Half an hour earlier, 180 hours a year to use in a fresher, clearer mind. I mean, that I just felt that was just so, I was moved by that, because it's true, because, you know, you have a busy day, and then there's a sloping down, like you run out of gas, and it's just better just to call it a night earlier. And then get a better quality day. So that's part of his secret. Now, here's the question. It sounds very simple. Oh, just go to bed half an hour earlier. Why is that actually very hard to do? It sounds like super simple. Okay, so Shane is wavering her smartphone at me. But you do eventually stop holding the phone. You're not holding the phone all night long. So why is it, but we have to go a little deeper psychologically. Why is that a challenge? Scott?
I mean, it's just, for me, it's a challenge, because it's like, you know, you're up and you're watching one extra episode of like a show or something. You know what I mean? You're trying to like.
Well, Netflix does not make it easy when you have that auto,
right.
You have 10 seconds to turn off the extra episode. And before you know it, you
can squeeze one more in.
Right. Right, squeeze one. You know, you went for an episode, you got a season.
Right.
I'm sure this happened to nobody, you know, never. Never happened. Very, everybody here on this call is very disciplined. Just watches the show they wanted on Netflix. Got it. Okay. I heard that happens to other people, but anyways, go on. So you want, one extra show, but I would like to suggest a reason for that. During the day, you got work, you got chores, you got responsibilities. You got to do a lot of annoying things. Okay. And therefore the nighttime is your time. That's your discretionary time. You can do it anything you want. It's your time. You can slice up that challah as fat or as thin as you want. You can do whatever you want with it. And the bottom line is, so you feel there's a tremendous sense of entitlement. You don't want to cut into the entertainment part of the day because you earned that entitlement. In order, you were a good person. You did your chores. You did your responsibilities. You followed the phone call. You sent the email. You did this. You did that. You went to the shop. You did the laundry. You want to have a break, which you should have a break. So that's why it's very hard to turn off, even though what he's saying is not rocket science. But actually, if you can do that, he's so right that, you know, better to exchange a half an hour of like veg time, which is, you know, not so productive and not so amazing on the entertainment either. Exchange it for a half an hour earlier, more energetic time. Exercise, learn. You know, think about plan your day, whatever the, you know, take Finn for a walk, you know, all kinds of fun stuff. Exactly. Okay. Now let's get into the Parsha. Right now. Here we go. All right. Parsha Balotcha starts off. Let's have Shana read it, Bavakasha. Take it away.
Rabbi, you're sharing your background, your desktop, not the.
That is not going to be too helpful. Let me try that again.
While you're doing that, just to second the whole point that you're making, the other good thing about going to bed half an hour earlier and waking up an hour earlier is that you also wake up less groggy and wake up with a lot more energy, which just completely changes the whole tone for the rest of the day.
Right. If you gotta hit that at the end of this REM cycle, you know, sweetly, you know, that's also true. So, all right. So take it away. Parshas Balotcha.
Lighting the lamp. God spoke to Moses, telling him to speak to Aaron and say to him, "When you light the lamps, the seven lamps shall illuminate the menorah." Aaron did that, lighting the lamps to illuminate the menorah as Hashem commanded Moshe. The menorah was made of a single piece of beaten gold. Everything from its base to its blossom consisted of a single piece of beaten metal. The menorah was thus made exactly according to the vision that Hashem showed Moshe.
Okay, so, all right, so, hold on one second, I think I left that apostrophe here. Sorry. So it says, when you light the lamp, the seven lamps should illuminate the menorah. In other words, the menorah here is the center staff. That's the key thing. What it means is that you have, well, now the Sforno is going to explain this. Now I'll read the Sforno.
Balotcha etane wrote, when you kindle the six lamps, el mul penei hamenorah, facing the lamp on the center shaft. This means that the wick is to be inclined towards the center shaft so that the flames will point in this direction from the respective sides of the menorah. Then and only then, all seven lamps will fulfill their function of illuminating and being the conduits of spiritual light descending onto the Jewish people. Obviously, the individual lamps would be able to provide physical light before being positioned in the manner described.
Okay, so just before we go on. So therefore, that Aaron, when he lit the candles, the wicks had to be facing toward the center. So you had three lamps on each side. The menorah had seven. You had the center, center shaft that had one bowl with a wick in it, and that went straight up. And you had three bowls at the top of the menorah, and the wicks were pointed toward the center, okay? And now the Sforno can explain, well, what's the significance of that? Why are they supposed to direct in that way? Go on.
The Musar, allegorical lesson, conveyed by the lights of the menorah, is us that only by the right side, representing preoccupation with eternal values, life in the future, working together with the left side, which represents the concerns with physical life on our planet, will we be able to attain our purpose on Earth? Our sages phrased it thus, if not for the input from celestial regions, spiritual input, the creatures on Earth would not be able to survive at all. I have not found this precise quote, but it means more literally that if there were no wise people who could tutor the uneducated, the world as we know it would collapse. In order for this universe to function as God wanted it to, all social levels of the people have to make their respective contributions. A major function of the combined activity by the tutored and the uneducated is to ensure that God's name would be hailed, revered, and enthusiastically acknowledged by every segment of mankind, all of his creatures. An example of such a thing happening is found in Shemot, the emphasis here being on the word Yechido.
I'll just translate. And the entire nation responded together. And he says, whatever Hashem tells us, we'll do. So the emphasis here is being on the word Yachdav, i.e. all people in unison will combine to carry God's will. So according to the Sforno, what are the three wicks on the right side representing, and what are the three wicks on the left side facing the center represent or compared to?
So he says the right side, to read the English, it was the preoccupation with eternal values, life in the future, and working together. So I'm translating that as like, that's the Torah, our like the religious component or our connection to Hashem.
So it's talking about people, I guess, rabbis and teachers who are involved essentially in that activity. And the left side of the menorah are?
He says physical life on our planet, on attaining our purpose on Earth. So that's basically like our day-to-day lives.
All right, so people who are essentially involved in making a living, you know, that's your central preoccupation. So what's his essential, so the fact that they're all pointing together toward the center, what is that really trying to convey?
That you have to have both sides to be able to fully live?
Yes, you have to, you have both elements, both parties have to be there in order to have the society, the Jewish society, and ultimately the world to exist. So everybody, in order, the Jewish community has to work in unison. Everybody has to provide their contribution. Okay. So the center, of course, refers toward the way of Hashem. So that the cumulative efforts of both of the people who are skilled in Torah and those people who are skilled in work. Both people, each one brings their skills, their contribution to the Jewish community, and therefore you have as he said, the spiritual light descending to the Jewish people. Okay, now, how can the Jewish people can be compared to a three-legged? Based upon this, how could you compare the Jewish people to a three-legged stool?
You have your relationship with yourself, your relationship with your fellow man, and your relationship with God, although that is probably not just for Judaism.
Right. So using what Moshe Smith said earlier, relationship with God, relationship with your family, relationship with work. So that exists on a personal level. It also, what the Sforno is saying, that also exists on a national level. There are people who are essentially, their role is to teach Torah and help other people connect with God. There are people who excel in work, you know, in their working with their families and building family life to them and their, you know, the community at large. And the people who excel at work. The point being is that the key point is that the Jewish community is not supposed to have, 10 million of the exact same Jew. They're supposed to have a variety of people who each one has their own strengths and talents, and they bring that to bear to help the Jewish community flourish. You know what I'm saying? And one side of the right side of the menorah represents people who are helping teach Torah, learn Torah, and that part. That's one side. And the other people are there who help the Jewish people grow in its physical needs. You know what I'm saying? So that's his basic motif. That's why all the candles are toward the center, that everybody together working in unison with all their respective contributions, do you have success? Now, with that, I'm going to blend based upon the lessons we learned from Morris Smith and based on the lessons we learned from the Sforno. I got a couple of, this gets to the question, which is the title, when should you walk away from a race? Here we go. Stan Amgier was offered a huge promotion in the company, which included a great new title, a great bump in pay, and a wonderful new office. Stan's first reaction is to say, is the decision is a no-brainer. What additional factors does the lesson of the menorah's light and Moshe Smith's three-legged stool teach him to consider in making his decision?
What you're going to give up. Like, this new job comes with new...
Unpack that, Scott. Yeah.
They're not paying you more money because they like you. They're paying you more money because they want you to do more.
Correct.
So it's going to take up more of your time.
Yes.
From your other legs.
Exactly. Right. So most people would immediately, when a company starts flashing the dollars and the prestige and you're going to get a special assistant and you're going to have the corner office and you'll have keys to the executive bathroom, all the corporate perks, whatever it may be, okay? But as Scott so eloquently says, the most expensive thing is to get something for free. So they're not giving it to you because they love you. They give it to you because you're helping them on their bottom line. And that is going to cause some of your other legs to get shorter. And the work leg of your stool is going to get longer. Now, you have to decide. Now, the bottom line is that you may want to be in a certain Jewish community and you want to pay for certain kinds of stuff. You want your kids to go to a certain kind of yeshiva. So your expenses may be, you might have to say, I need to invest in this for the next 5 years because I want to have a Jewish lifestyle. I'm just saying, there's no one answer for everybody. But you do have to ask what Scott asked. I understand what I'm getting. What am I giving up? Because it is, there's only a certain amount of hours in the week. And you know, you're, if you got that promotion, you're probably working pretty hard before. Okay. As such, what are you going to have to give up in order to do that? That's the question. Now, most people don't think in these kind of terms. I mean, you know, this is just talking about a promotion, but obviously Moshe Smith is the most, you know, he walked away from the top, one of the top mutual funds in America in 1992. It was so bizarre. I didn't even tell you this. It got covered in the Wall Street Journal. Okay. That was, and they wrote it like, you know, he's going to Israel to learn Talmud. You know what I'm saying? Like that was like in 1992, that seemed like, you know, he's on drugs. Okay. So, all right, that's scenario number one, but if you take away anything from that, if that Vince Lombardi three legged stool metaphor is a powerful one, and you have to see if the legs in your stool are relatively balanced. Okay. Scenario number two, Nancy Amgier has a wonderful chavrusa in Alana. They love learning and hanging out. Alana asked her to consider adding another session of learning in their week together. What additional factors do the lessons of the menorah's light and Moshe Smith's three-legged stool teach Nancy to consider making her decision? What should she consider? What are some of the variables? Is it an automatic yes? Is it automatic no? What do you think?
Depends what she has going on. With the other legs in her life, so to speak.
So give me a reason that she should say yes, and give me a scenario when she should say no.
If she's supposed to be getting a promotion at work and it's on the horizon, then perhaps she has to spend some more time at work for a certain period of time, and wouldn't be able to add that additional learning.
Good. In other words, right now she feels that she has to, you know, put more effort in her, on her work leg, because she's trying to, you know, establish herself or whatever. And it's not a time to put that in jeopardy by sticking more things in her overburdened schedule. That's number one. Good. When would she think that? When should she say yes to Alana?
If she's in a growth mode, so to speak, and doesn't have and has free time, like I think they said 180 hours he calculated. I mean, I guess it's different.
No, 180 hours if you go to bed a half an hour earlier, and then you regain a half an hour per day awake time.
Right. So I guess depending on which, that plus whatever other free time she has, like in the evening, or anyway, whatever free time she has in the evening, she would have to calculate to see what, or and not even take a better examination at what she has going on during those hours, and then decide if she could allot an additional hour or whatever it is to learning, and if it was going to be for a specific period of time.
Excellent. In other words, yeah, she might say, like, you know, I'm you know, I happen to be doing about 8 or 10 hours of Netflix a week. I can afford to give one of them back and invest more in myself by, you know, learning with my good Chavrusa Alana for one more time a week. Yeah, I'll just have to be a little more disciplined. But you're right. See, my point is that these questions are not yes or no questions. They have to be, you know, using the, what side of the menorah am I doing well in? How are my legs and my three-legged stool doing? Was the question. All right, we got another one. Chaim MGR is invited to spend a Pesach in a fancy resort in Puerto Rico with all single friends. This would mean that he would not be spending Pesach with his family. It may also mean that the spiritual character of Pesach will be more fun in the sun versus learning and davening. Chaim, we're talking about you, Chaim, although it's not you, Chaim. Chaim MGR, so I'm going to say it again, that we're just talking about the three-legged stool. Chaim MGR is invited to spend Pesach in a fancy resort in Puerto Rico with all his single friends. This would mean that he would not be spending Pesach with a family. It may also mean that the spiritual character of his Pesach meal will be more fun in the sun versus learning and davening. What additional factors do the lessons of the menorah's light and Moshe Smith's three-legged stool teach him to consider making his decision? What do you guys say? Pesach in beautiful Puerto Rico, white sandy beaches, lots of fun with the guys. I got a smile out of Chaim.
Yeah, Pesach in Miami Beach. We had 1,000 people from Hasidim to non-religious for Shvisha Pesach doing Kriyas Yamsov and singing and dancing by the beach. It was so beautiful. That's very what good. It reminds me. I did Pesach in Spain with a bunch of singles, and we got a great deal, and we had a great rabbi there, and we had a fabulous time. So it's whatever.
Chaim is saying you could actually have it both, but the question is that obviously that would be not much of a challenge, but I'm trying to create a where it has to be a conflict where there'll be less.
I don't know. I think Rebbe, I think your challenge wasn't much of a challenge either. I think everybody else knows where you're going with this and what the answer is also. The question is on the person and today what they do with their
face. But the truth is it asserts that it's not really a stream because everything has to be a careful calculation. The answer is he might need it. You know, he could be coming into Pesach, he's burnt out. He's had no fun, no vacations, working his tail off. He's exhausted. He needs to have his funometer is on real low. And you need a little recharge. You got to be, you know, there's no black and white in life. There's very rarely black and white answers. It requires a calculation. And I think
you can also think like, I've already made the decision that I'll spend, you know, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah with them.
Right.
One of the two.
Yeah, you find a compensation. Right. So in other words, doesn't mean that you have to spend every Pesach with your whole family, every single Pesach necessarily. So, So the point being is that you have a, you have three legs. You have your relationship with God, your relationship with your family, your relationship with work, and so therefore you have to balance it all out and make the calculation. But sometimes you need to be on vacation, you need a break, and you can't be working all 24/6. So you gotta figure out how are your legs? Is your three-legged stool balanced, or is it too much work? Is it too much between you and God? Is it too much with the family? You gotta cheshbon that out. You gotta be realistic for yourself. What I'm sharing today is that these are not black and white answers. It's subject to assessment. Just like we had the case of a guy got the huge promotion, just like the answer is not necessarily yes, and it's honestly no. It depends on your circumstance. How are you balancing out the various parts of your life? A charusa. Add another charusa. Well, maybe you're burnt out and it's going to be terrible because you just don't got enough. You don't got no gas in the tank. On the other hand, if you're logging in 10, 15 hours of Netflix, maybe you can shave off and invest another an hour in the old learning department with your best charusa of all time. And conversely, is it going on vacation in Pesach? You got to cheshbon it out. Or if you recognize that, as what Chaim says, you can try to make sure that even though there'll be fun in the sun, there'll be other spiritually enhancing things to make sure it's not really just a vacation that happens on Pesach, but is in fact a Pesach vacation. And there's a big difference. So, all right, these are things to think about. And I think that some of the lessons that Moshe Smith brought, I think are very valuable. And specifically, I think just on personal excellence, the idea of that unproductive late night hours of trying to go to sleep and getting a half an hour early, such a win if you can do it. But it's much harder than it sounds. Much harder than it sounds. Takes a lot of discipline. Anyways, all right, guys. Have a lala tov. I hope to see tomorrow night is the MG dinner. I hope to see people there. And all the very best, guys. Lala tov.
Rabbi, hearing all the discussions on this reminds me of the book Essentialism, where yes. Greg, yes. I don't know how you say his last name, but his whole thing is that when you say yes to something, you're saying no to something else.
Correct.
And when you make your decisions and you make your choices, to really think about, like, if I'm saying yes to going out to dinner with my friends, what am I saying no to? On
right.
The other end,
that's a perfect corollary to the three-legged stool analogy. If you're growing one leg, your other legs are getting shorter, and your stool is getting more wobbly and unstable as time goes on. So yeah, the idea from the book Essentialism, we actually featured that idea. That was actually a hat tip to Shana in this year's senior fellowship a couple months ago. Scott was there, so did that. So yeah, that's the same idea. So you can't the art of saying no and recognizing that by saying yes, you are automatically saying no to other things because there's a limited amount of hours of the day. There's a limited amount of energy that you have, and you want to be able to prioritize which is critically important. It's the same idea. And going back to the menorah has their three branches that represent. The people who are focused on spirituality in the community, teaching Torah, et cetera, being leaders in that way, and those people who are taking care of the material needs of the Jewish community. And everybody's contribution is important. And the question is, within oneself, how much of the left side and how much of the right side do I have? And do I need to recalibrate? That's the question, which is the same question that the Essentialism book also thinks. Assessing my priorities, what am I spending my time on? What can I cut out? What do I want? How do I want to grow? What do I have to give up to accomplish that? And is that something that I really want to do? These are important questions that people do not spend the time doing. And I think it's that's why I bring in the most exceptional case of one guy who stepped away from Fidelity when he brought the fund from 13 billion to 20 billion to just walk away and spend a year learning in Israel, which turned into seven. Is a sort of a remarkable story, but that's an extreme case. Obviously, I want an extreme case because I want to make it interesting. But got to have the entertainment factor. But even on a more limited level, we all make these kind of decisions. So it's something to really think about and be which goes back to the idea of being intentional and being reflective. Very important. Very sounds easy. Easy to talk about, not so easy to do. Also very similar to the, it does tell nicely to the atomic habits of doing 1%. Not going for the grand slam home run, not for the triple double, just going for the get on base. That's it. You want to exercise? Step one, just put on your exercise clothing and step outdoors. The rest will take care of itself. All right, guys. Lila Tov. I'll hopefully see some of you tomorrow. All the best. Okay.
All right, Rabbi.
I used James Clear's